Probably. Most people think of a big holiday, Thanksgiving, Christmas, Mother's Day, Easter, as a reason to have a roast. Well, for one, there's a lot of food, and you'll need people to eat it. But roast is at least as much a process as it is to a particular thing, and not restricted to a turkey or a crown roast or a leg of lamb. A roast can be a chicken, or a duck, or a pound of sirloin, not ground. Have you roasted a piece of beef at home? Maybe a whole chicken. Do you wonder what to do with the pan drippings? Do you know that you can use them? Today we are covering roasts, which is chapter 12 of Escoffier's Le Guide Culinaire. The Eating Liberty Podcast, episode 280, Food and Freedom, once a week for life. Hello folks, Dan Reed here. Welcome back to the show. My culinary training includes working for two certified master chefs. The principles of cooking as found in Auguste Escoffier's teachings were the foundation for that experience. I've taught these skills at culinary school and in commercial kitchens, and now I'm sharing them with you. Chapter 12 is pretty short. The principles are pretty simple. Let's just jump in. This is the opening of the chapter. In any comparison between the two normal methods of roasting, that on a spit will be found superior to that done in an oven. This is because of the big differences between the two methods and has nothing to do with the kind of fuel that is used. This fact is easily explained, for regardless of all the care taken with roasting, even in a closed oven, it is not possible to avoid producing steam when carrying out the process. The effect of this steam is so much the worse the more delicate the flavor of the item being roasted, and the more easy it is to ruin its quality. As against this, spit roasting is carried out in a dry, open atmosphere which enables the joint to retain its own particular flavor. This shows the superiority of spit roasting over oven roasting, more especially so when concerning small game birds. In some establishments and under certain conditions, no choice of method is possible, and for better or worse, roasting has to be carried out in the oven, but at least every effort should be made to avoid the effects of steam referred to above. End quote. Now, wild game and lean cuts of meat, all the tenderloins, pork and veal loins, can benefit from barding or larding. Now, I've discussed that on the various chapters, and we will revisit it here a little bit. I'm also going to get back to a little bit about the spit roasting and oven roasting. Barding is placing thin slices of fat, usually pork fatback, on the surface of the meat. Usually, it would be put on pork or veal, since they're fairly lean, and game birds, to protect the outside from becoming too cooked, too crusty, and too hard to cut or to eat. There is an intended effect of also allowing some of the fat to be absorbed by the meat. I'm not fully convinced this achieves the intended goal. Barding to protect the outside of the meat from being too crunchy, crispy, charred absolutely does work. Barded meats should be allowed at the last minute of cooking to sear in the oven and develop that crust and that flavor, and we do that simply by cutting the string and taking that fat off. Larding is sewing pieces of fat back into the lean piece of meat. Now, this sounds kind of weird, but there's a special larding needle, which is probably 7 inches long or so, and has like a weird little reverse alligator clip at the end, which holds, it's not spring-loaded exactly, but it holds the piece of fat. Usually you'd cut it maybe, a quarter of an inch square would be kind of fat, maybe 3/16 of an inch. Eighth of an inch is too small. There's some, kind of tiny, and is maybe 4 or 5 inches long. And you literally just sew this needle into the meat and then back out again to put this piece of fat inside the middle of the meat. And you can do it so that when you make a cross section of the cut, you see kind of an even distribution of the pieces of fat. So that's larding. Like barding, it is intended to allow some of the fat to melt into the meat. Larded meat also has the added effect, a good one, of having some fat to eat with each lean bite. Now, I'll accept that most Americans probably aren't really used to that, but having a piece of fat with a lean piece of meat does make the whole chewing and eating experience better because fat is flavor. Now, about spit roasting a little bit, let's talk about this. The theory of spit roasting can be summarized in this statement. Regulate the degree of intensity of heat according to the kind of meat, its size, its inherent qualities, and how long it has been hung. Experience is the surest guide in all matters concerning spit roasting, for no matter how detailed the theory of roasting may have been given, it cannot do more than outline the basic principles. It cannot replace the telling glance and the know-how which comes only from long practice. End quote. It's almost like, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice, practice. Now, Escoffier does offer these tips. Red meat should be seared quickly. Now, let's just clarify this point. Seared here is not in direct contact with heat, like it would be on a pan-seared something or other. So red meat should be seared quickly over hot embers, then roasted over those embers with no flames, so the heat penetrates without charring the outside. White meat should be cooked well done, and over a sufficient heat to develop a good crust and to complete the cooking at the same time. Game birds should be roasted over wood with a small amount of flame instead of glowing ember heat. Escoffier offers what woods to avoid for spit roasting, and those are resinous woods, so pine. Juniper smells grand in the fireplace, and I love the outside smell from my neighbors when they're burning it, but I'm not certain I want that flavor on my food. One of the things that happens in both cases of roasting is once you make that sear, and you can do a sear in an oven as well. We'll talk about that in a minute. But once you start it, it continues even as you're cooking it slightly far away from the heat source, be that the ember or the flame. So we'll talk about near the end a little bit about how to know how much heat versus how much meat. It's inexact, but there are some guidelines. Oven roasting is something that most of us are familiar with because, you know, Thanksgiving and Christmas and whatever. The biggest concern for a roast is that it is to be elevated off the bottom of the roasting pan. Now, a roasting pan doesn't have to be that graniteware thing that you use for turkeys. It could be a sheet pan. Whatever it is you're using that day, that's your roasting pan, even if it's a cookie sheet. Getting the meat off the pan can be managed with a rack or by placing metal skewers that hang over the edge of the pan so that the meat rests off the bottom of the pan. The chief reason for this is We want the heat to develop a sear all the way around. We don't want to risk the meat being burned on the pan or cooking and kind of frying in its own fat. What we want to have happen is we want the pan free to gather all the pan drippings and the rendered fat, so we can use that for a pan sauce. Now, if you don't have a rack that fits your cookie sheet or whatever you're using, and you don't have metal skewers that will go over the edge, putting down some long sticks of celery and carrot and leeks, parsnips if you've got it, fennel if you've got it, something that even through the cooking process may squish a little bit, but will still keep the meat off the bottom of the pan, that's a good option, and it has the added benefit of giving you more flavor for your pan gravy from those drippings. Now, oven roasting is, by its nature, going to create pan drippings and gathered rendered fat. We want that. Spit roasting will also create drippings and rendered fat. How to catch them is the trick. At one job at a hotel, restaurant at a hotel, they had a gas-fired rotisserie cooker, and I think it held 4 spits. So we could do maybe, I think it was a dozen chickens or 4 strip loins at one time. It was really, it was a very fun thing to look at. It was a lot of fun to watch, fairly easy to use. And the heat source, so it was on a wall, so the heat source was behind, and as the meats were turning, all the fat and drippings went down. Now, unfortunately, that was designed in such a way that getting them was not particularly easy, and take the tray out, and then it's still dripping. So, unfortunately, I don't think we made much use of those pan drippings, which was a terrible oversight and design, but that's another thing. When we're spit roasting at home, probably doing it on a heat source that is below the meat. So if you put a pan to catch the drippings, the first thing that's happening is you're blocking the heat. If you happen to catch any drippings or rendered fat, the next thing that's going to happen is they're going to burn, which we don't want to have happen. A good caramelization on those pan drippings is exactly what we want, because that's going to give us the flavor we're looking for in that pan gravy. Burned, of course, is just garbage. So the process to start making the gravy is to deglaze the pan. Now, Scafe does make a point that pan gravy isn't the same as a well-made sauce, and if you've got lots of fat, certainly pour off most of the fat. But because fat is flavor, what we do not want to have is a fat-free pan gravy, because just those caramelized bits that have been reconstituted by the water that you're going to use to release them will have some flavor, but really the fat is what we want. So we want some fat in our pan gravy, because that's going to carry the flavor. So, and his point is, we're not making consommé, we're making pan gravy, so we want the flavor there. So deglazing is, your roast is resting, and we'll talk about that in a minute too. And strain off most of the fat, keep it, makes great eggs tomorrow morning. Put that pan on a burner on medium heat, like 2 or 3, if that's how your oven works. And with some water, pour the 1/8 inch, 1/4 inch of water in the pan. And as it's heating up, using a wooden spoon, you can scrape the pan drippings. And what's happening is that they're reconstituting. What's left there, they had water in them. And as they cooked, the water evaporated, leaving behind protein and amino acids are protein, so mostly protein and maybe some collagen, gelatin, which when it comes in contact with water, liquefies, and that's what's going to get all this stuff up. It also makes cleaning the pan easier, but flavor is what we're looking for. So wooden spoon to release all that over, and in a few minutes, you're going to see that it's all going to come up. And if the pan boils a little teeny bit, that's fine. Not boil too much because we're going to reduce out what we've made here, and you can add water to that. So suppose you have a really nice big strip loin or prime rib, and the dripping part is surprisingly not too much. Got a lot of fat, which is great for other uses. Make beef fat mayonnaise. Yeah, buddy. But those pan drippings aren't going to give you a lot. So what do we do? Well, that's where having a stock of the thing, in this case beef, would be to our benefit. So a well-made beef stock. Have that on the stove and strain your pan drippings into that beef stock. Bring that to a boil. Thicken that with the slurry of cornstarch or arrowroot. And now you have your pan gravy. And of course, adjust the seasoning. Now, the escoffier method for this is, it takes several hours, and it's hardly even worth going into. It's one of those, oh my gosh, this is why classical French is such a pain in the butt. Well, we don't need to do all that. We can make accommodations for things that are easier to do. Now, in this little chapter, Escoffier offers two steps or procedures which I don't agree with. The first is basting. Basting done properly is pouring fat, liquefied fat, over the meat. It's never stock or water. Water-based liquids will wash off the fat on the outside and soften up any crust that you're making. Fat won't do that. In fact, it will help actually sort of cook the outside a little bit, which is fine, but the intended goal seems to be that the fat used in basting will penetrate the meat in the mere seconds of contact it has before gravity pulls it back down into the pan again. Now, I've discussed this previously on other shows. I don't think the result is worth the effort. I've never been satisfied with what basting has produced, which includes the possible little burns on my fingers trying to get that fat on the meat. The other suggestion he makes is to serve the roast or game bird immediately. Now, meat benefits immensely from a rest. If you've ever seen the serving tray of a Thanksgiving turkey after the birds have been carved too soon, it is full of juice that should have been in the bird. So too with a prime rib or crown roast or a leg of lamb and my tri-tip. A resting period is crucial to keeping the moisture in the meat. Everything about the eating experience is made better. Now, the amount of time to rest the meat is going to vary from cut to cut. And a tri-dip is not a particularly big piece of meat compared to a whole prime rib. Tri-dip is kind of puny. Now, here's the really weird part. I've let my tri-dip rest. I put it into a piece of aluminum foil and then put that into two Ziploc bags just in case the first one leaks. And then wrap that into a couple of towels and leave that as a bundle on the counter for 30 minutes. No kidding. 30 minutes. It didn't take that long to cook. And what happens at the end of that 30 minutes in the bag is going to be a lot of just spectacular juice because there's nothing I can do about that. Searing is not a waterproof treatment for meat. Liquid will come out. But the liquid that remains in the meat stays in the meat. So when you cut a steak too soon, even the steak they serve you at the restaurant, you'll see juice comes out on your plate or juice comes out on your cutting board. And in the case of a tri-tip, there's a lot of juice in there. And if I don't let it rest long enough, it's going to come out. And so if it's coming out of the meat, that means it's not in any one bite. And the more meat, the more liquid that comes out of the meat, the drier and less flavorful and chewier thy meat's going to be. Now, how that's a benefit, I don't really know. I have a suggestion. I have an idea about why he said that. To me, resting period is absolutely mandatory. It's like baking. Bread is not done just because it came out of the oven. Bread requires 20 minutes or longer to finish baking, so all the things go back the way they're supposed to. Same thing with a roasted piece of meat. It needs time to rest so all the juice stays inside. Now, Escoffier does go into a few sides and presentation ideas between the English way, which is kind of an older fashioned way than his then modern French way. That's interesting, but I'm not going to cover it here. Now, he discusses cuts of meat that probably we can't find or wouldn't even buy if we could find, like a whole high, the whole saddle of beef. Well, that's a gigantic piece of meat. That's 50 people or something. That's crazy. It's ridiculous. No one's doing that. What we can find is we can find whole strip loins, we can find prime rib, we can find whole tenderloins. There is also whole brisket, but brisket, really to me, brisket's the thing that you wouldn't just roast. You have to brine for either corned beef or, well, you could smoke it low and slow, which would take 12 hours. It's a really good idea, but we're not doing that. Yeah, I suppose if you really wanted to, you could find a steam chip, which is the whole rear leg of the cow, if you really wanted to. That's a, I don't know about your oven, but my oven won't hold that. It's a massive, gigantic thing. So roasting a piece of meat properly starts with understanding the relationship between the roast's size and the heat required. The smaller the piece of meat, that tri-tip, the higher the temperature and shorter cooking time is required. A large piece of meat, that steam chip is the largest, but even a prime rib, requires a medium heat to begin with, and then lower heat for a longer period of time. Now, the basic principle is that the bigger the piece of meat, the longer time is required at a lower temperature to make sure that the cooking is even throughout. If you've ever been to a buffet and seen at the end of the line, they have that, it could be a steamship, it could be a prime rib. And you see the cut of the prime rib, and it's just gray, 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 then bang, a slug of pink. It was cooked at too high a temperature for too short a time. It wasn't cooked right. So what you're going to get when you eat that is dry, 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 then flavor in the middle. So it's more tragic than anything else. But the larger the piece, the slower the amount of heat, the slower time and lower amount of heat, so that everything stays nice and pink and delicious. Higher heat to get that sear, and then because it's smaller, it doesn't take as much time for the heat to go in and get to the center of the meat. And that principle remains in the for the roast in the slow heat oven. Once you get that char, that sear, this is what we, so in the oven, we're going to get the sear. We're going to start the oven, let's say we're doing that tri-tip in the oven. Start it at 450. Get it nice and hot. Your tri-tip is on a rack, on a roasting pan. It goes in, and give it 5 or 6 minutes. Get a good sear on it, and then turn the temperature down to 350. As, even though it's a lower temperature, the caramelization and crust is going to continue to develop. Now, that same principle applies to that prime rib or the steam chip. You're going to get the sear at a lower temperature for a longer period of time, but still then, once you get that sear started, lower the temperature, it's going to continue to creating that sear, and that's the thing that, one, is going to render the fat on the outside, which makes the good crust. It's going to taste better, because it's like, wow, this is, you know, it's fun to eat. We like to eat that stuff. It's kind of primal. And it's going to help give us that good color on the outside, which is what we want to see. We want to see it, smell it, and taste it. And one advantage we have now that Escoffier didn't have was oven-safe thermometers. They even have the kind of thermometer where the probe is on a cord. You stick the probe in the meat, put the meat in the oven, and the probe comes out and close the oven door and you attach it to this little thingy, looks like a cell phone, and it will read your temperature for you. You never even have to open the oven and check the temperature of the meat. It's brilliant. So that's the thing we can have. Since we're going to allow our roasts to rest, that means they will continue to cook even after they're out of the oven. A turkey will increase by about 15 degrees. Now, you probably know this is called carryover cooking. A tri-tip will increase generally 10 degrees, sometimes 15. It depends on things, but strip loin or prime rib may easily increase 15, possibly even 20 degrees as it sits there and carries up. Now, my suspicion about why Escoffier said serve meat immediately is this. The crust developed will not get better as the meat rests. I see this with roasted chicken. The skin is all crispy and inviting. And it's like, oh my goodness, I can just already taste how crunchy this is going to be. And it gets a little less crispy while I'm waiting for the chicken to reach its final carry-up temperature. The trade-off is crispy skin and dry meat, or slightly less crispy skin and delicious meat. It's an easy choice for me to make. Roasts are pretty easy. They're big and they can be intimidating because there's a substantial cash investment. And so I understand the anxiety and trepidation that goes into this. And like, what if I screw it up? There's a lot of cash here. Well, fair enough. It's a valid point. Follow the basic principles, and I think you're going to be fantastic. I think it's going to work out fine. Most of the things in this chapter are spared sort of that almost quintessential Escoffier treatment with amazing ingredients and labor. However, he doesn't disappoint. Google Escoffier procedure 3914, truffled young turkey. aside from visualizing you doing the steps, just visualize the end result, because this is actually going to be a rotisserie thing. And it's like, a spit roast thing. It's like, wow. I can't even, it boggles my mind to think about. And I've never done it, and I couldn't, no place I ever worked could afford it. But it certainly is fun to read, to get that, to see him at all his Escoffier glory. All right, folks, that's going to do it. The text of this episode will be on the show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/280. I'll add a link to a thermometer with the cord probe so you can check your roasts without checking your roasts. It even works on the grill and on the smoker. Have a good week, and I'll see you soon. Music for the Culinary Libertarian podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.